affect the outcomes and the teachings and the role modeling you need for your children and your family structures.
This is Eric Galatis.
For the first time in more than 40 years, India, Poland, and Hungary have sent astronauts into space for a private flight to the International Space Station. The multinational crew successfully lifted off from NASA's Kennedy Space Center, reaching orbit in 9 minutes. The three countries share the tab for the mission, where ticket prices were over $65 million per seat. The mission was delayed several times due to mechanical issues with the ISS, the launch capsule, and the booster itself. This is the second time the booster, named the Falcon 9, has been used and is debuting a new capsule in the Dragon series that includes multiple new design upgrades. The company sponsoring this mission is Axiom Space, a company making plans to create the world's first commercial space station named Axiom Station. Axiom Space will also be attaching several commercial modules to the ISS while it's still operational, then detaching from the station and becoming part of the future planned Axiom Station once decommissioned. The mission will last 14 days, during which the crew will be conducting several scientific studies and experiments for more than 31 countries' collaborative research plan. You're listening to a summer membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Isabel Charlet, and Farah Siddiqui. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer's Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our summer fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $50,000 by June 29th. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth coming up next.
The Media Zillas! It's a bird! It's a plane! It's community radio!
By the mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Bombing and talking. The U.S., Iran, and Israel. Trump's national security team is a mess. And U.S.-Japan defense talks are in trouble. First, bombing and talking. Will talks between the U.S. and Iran and the ceasefire between Iran and Israel last? Will they bring peace? These are the top questions following the stand-down by all three sides on Monday. Iran launched 10 missiles at the U.S. base in Qatar, but warned the U.S. in advance, allowing the base to be cleared. Trump thanked Iran and said on his Truth Social, quote, "Iran has officially responded to our obliteration of their nuclear facilities with a very weak response, which we expected and have very effectively countered. There have been 14 missiles fired," said Trump, "but there were no casualties." Then Trump offered this playground-level assessment, quote, "Most importantly, they've gotten it all out of their system, and there will hopefully be no further hate. Perhaps Iran can now proceed to peace and harmony in the region, and I will enthusiastically encourage Israel to do the same." Later in the day, Trump announced that Israel and Iran had agreed to a ceasefire, now in its second day. How long it will last is anybody's guess. No doubt all sides will claim victory, but surely not a victory for peace. Israel has devastated Iran's military capabilities and leadership in what can only be called an act of aggression. The 10 days of attacks were a political victory for Prime Minister Netanyahu and the fulfillment of long-standing plans to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities. Yet many observers are not convinced that he or Trump completely succeeded or as claimed. Experts point to hundreds of pounds of enriched uranium that remain unaccounted for and may have been moved or previously buried. The nuclear research labs apparently were hit but not completely destroyed. A preliminary U.S. intelligence report from the Defense Intelligence Agency, obtained by the New York Times, says that Iran's nuclear program may only have been set back by a few months. Various U.S. officials are disputing the report, hewing to Trump's line about obliteration. That leaves open the possibility that Iran will still be able to pursue production of nuclear weapons, an aim it had not attempted to achieve until now. Meantime, Iran's political leadership remains intact, despite Netanyahu's clear goal of regime change. Trump's statement urging an end to hate is fatuous. Iran has been subjected to withering bombing. At least 600 civilians have been killed. Thousands of people, probably including many who despise the regime, have assembled to shout death to America. Nationalism remains a strong feature of Iran's politics. So, end of hate? Hardly. As for the U.S.-Iran talks, which Trump says will resume next week, they are on a different level since the U.S. became a belligerent in this war. Will Iran now cave in and agree to end all uranium enrichment? And what if Iran persists in its original position that enriching uranium for energy is a matter of sovereignty? The U.S. would do well to revive the 2015 nuclear deal, which capped enrichment, provided for international inspection, and insured against a nuclear breakout by Iran. Trump's national security team is a mess. In every previous U.S. administration since at least World War II, there was a clearly defined decision-making process. Each president charted a particular model, depending largely on his prior experience and his confidence in his national security advisor and secretary of state. The Trump presidencies have been another story. In his first term, Trump regularly promoted and demoted top foreign policy officials. On their part, the focus was on imposing guardrails around a know-nothing commander-in-chief. It has been apparent since day one of Trump's second term that his national security team has two dysfunctional features. It is largely composed of loyalists and not people with experience and competence, and in its actual functioning, it is Trump and the rest. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, always a reliable observer, reports that no more than a half dozen people have Trump's ear, with Trump most likely to follow the last of them to have it. Consequently, the outcome is likely to be unpredictable. As Trump demonstrated in the lead-up to bombing Iran, he is capable of changing his mind in an instant, from waiting 2 weeks to acting on impulse. Various reports indicate that the change caught the military and others by surprise, and not happily, since Trump was telegraphing U.S. actions. Those same officials were also surprised when Trump announced a ceasefire before Iran and Israel had actually agreed to one. And the claims of monumental destruction of Iran's nuclear sites, and the plea to oil companies not to raise prices, and the insistence that if Iran's a regime can't make Iran great again, it should be changed. Hard to know what to make of such careless utterances. Now we're seeing the results of this chaos. Most prominent among the unfit is Pete Hegseth, he of the Signal Group episode. Hegseth recently took heavy fire from Democratic senators when he testified about deployment of soldiers to U.S. cities. He simply refused to give a reason why that deployment was either necessary or effective. In the Middle East war, Hegseth has reportedly ceded key decision-making responsibility to his central command general, sidelining other Pentagon military officials and perhaps being sidelined himself. Then there's Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, whose affection for the now-departed Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad nearly derailed her nomination. She reportedly made the mistake, as Trump sees it, of citing intelligence findings that Iran is not close to having a nuclear bomb. "I don't care what she said," Trump said. Forget about the intelligence, in other words, since that finding contradicted his justification for war. Trump has reportedly sidelined Gabbard on Middle East affairs. Trump's team is a team of one. All he has to rely on are two billionaires, Howard Lutnick, the Secretary of Commerce, and Steve Witkoff, his chief negotiator with everyone, and a hawkish Secretary of State who was also his national security advisor. A very bad way to run an effective bureaucracy, assuming you value a diversity of opinion. One evidence that diversity of opinion is not welcome is the reported dissolution of an interagency working group under the National Security Council that was devoted to finding ways to push Russia to the bargaining table with Ukraine. According to Graham Slattery at Reuters, the working group found diminishing interest by Trump in pressing Russia, making the group's work useless. Then came the purging of the National Security Council, including dismissal of its Russia and Ukraine specialists. The fascinating flip side to this story appeared in a Telegraph article. It offers an explanation for what lay behind the disbandment of the National Security Council Working Group on Russia. A senior official in the U.S. State Department named Darren Beatty, who was appointed by Trump in early February, is a Kremlin stooge married to the daughter of a wealthy Russian businessman with close ties to Putin. Beatty, who has repeatedly expressed admiration for Putin, was instrumental in shutting down State Department and NSC programs designed to counter Kremlin propaganda. The Telegraph article notes, quote, "In the years before joining the government, Mr. Beatty wrote social media posts suggesting Western institutions should be, quote, infiltrated by Putin, while he also attacked what he described as the globalist American empire. Beatty may also qualify as a racist," says the Telegraph. Quote, "Mr. Beatty was a member of the first Trump administration, but after being sacked in 2018 for allegedly attending a white nationalist conference, he reinvented himself as an alt-right media figure." My third top story, U.S.-Japan defense talks are in trouble. In recent years, Japan has complied with long-standing U.S. wishes that it increase military spending. But apparently there is a limit to how big an increase Japan is willing to accept. Last week, Tokyo abruptly scrapped annual 2+2 security talks involving the allies' top diplomats and defense chiefs less than 2 weeks before the meeting, after the U.S. asked Japan to hike its defense budget to 5% of gross domestic product. That is far more than Japan's planners have in mind, which is 2% of GDP by 2027. A Pentagon spokesman says that the Trump administration has set a global standard for U.S. allies of 5% of GDP on the military. At the NATO meetings this week in The Hague, all members except Spain agreed to the 5% standard. Trump threatened Spain, saying it will have to, quote, pay twice as much in tariffs. For Japan, however, that figure would be politically risky, given its history, its economic situation, and most recently Trump's tariffs on autos and steel. So far, Japan has resisted the Trump administration's pressure to sign on to a new trade deal. In other news, North Korea is experiencing near-famine conditions, yet is sending more soldiers to fight in Ukraine. North Korea has experienced severe food shortages for the last 30 years, including famine in the 1990s that killed up to 3 million people. Now a report by the Bush School at Texas A&M University, in cooperation with the NGO Human Rights in North Korea, concludes that North Korea is experiencing a food emergency due to severe food shortages, reported widespread adoption of crisis coping strategies, and mass starvation-related deaths in 2021, continuing into 2022-23. The report finds that at least 20% of households in North Korea are experiencing severe food shortages. Acute malnutrition levels are expected to be between 15 to 30%, and between 1 to 2 people every day out of 10,000 are dying. The report also notes that the public distribution system for food has failed, leading the government to severely restrict access to food and food distribution. In the midst of this crisis, the Russian news agency is reporting that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will send 1,000 combat engineers and 5,000 military builders to help restore the Kursk region in Russian-occupied Ukraine. The announcement came after Sergei Shoigu, Secretary of the Security Council of Russia, visited North Korea. According to Shoigu, Moscow and Pyongyang also plan to create memorials for the Korean soldiers who died while liberating the Kursk region. There are around 11,000 North Korean soldiers serving in the Ukraine war. Next, a leaked phone call imperils Thailand's leader. In a phone call between Thailand's young prime minister and Cambodia's former leader, Petongtarn Sirnawatra seemed to belittle her country's military and cozy up to the Cambodian strongman Hun Sen. The conversation happened in the midst of a border dispute. The Thai Prime Minister's remarks suggested that Thailand would do anything necessary to placate Cambodia. Now calls are widespread in Thailand for the Prime Minister to resign, though she maintains that what she was doing was political theater, not negotiations. The leaked conversation could not have occurred at a worse time for Thailand, as it faces serious economic problems and Trump's tariff hikes. When a framework isn't a deal. On June 11 in London, Chinese and U.S. negotiators supposedly worked out a trade deal that would open the way for U.S. companies to obtain rare earth magnets, and the Chinese would again have access to U.S. high-tech exports. But 2 weeks in, there's no sign that the deal is being implemented. Bloomberg reports that, quote, while there has been a trickle of required permits, many American firms that need Chinese rare earth minerals are still waiting on Beijing's approval for shipments, according to people familiar with the process. China's system is improving but remains cumbersome, contrary to Trump's assurances that rare earths would flow up front. The Bloomberg report goes on to say that there is, quote, lingering confusion about what level of magnet approvals from China would trigger Trump to abandon his tit-for-tat export curbs. Even if export approvals accelerate, there are so many unknowns about the licensing regime that it's impossible for companies to have a strong sense of certainty about future supply, said one research director. At a minimum, they need to factor in a real possibility that talks could break down again and exports will be halted. Actually, both sides appear to be holding out, using their leverage with each other. China's rare earth minerals, U.S. technology exports, to wait out the other side. And China surely notices that on the U.S. side, withholding advanced tech exports is still in effect. The Trump administration announced last week that U.S. equipment cannot be supplied to Korean chipmakers' factories in China, according to the Wall Street Journal. Jeffrey Kessler, Undersecretary of Commerce for Industry and Security at the U.S. Commerce Department, notified Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix this week that he is revoking measures that waived their requirement to file applications whenever they supplied U.S.-made equipment to their China-based factories. Finally, a related story, forced labor in China's critical minerals production. Global Rights Alliance, an NGO based in The Hague, Netherlands, reports that China, using forced labor, quote, has now invested significant resources to expand critical mineral exploration, mining, processing, and manufacturing in Xinjiang. The region's rich mineral reserves and geographic proximity to China's trading partners have established it as a national extractive hub. The report focuses on lithium, titanium, and two other minerals that are in global demand and are being intensively mined and processed in Xinjiang for export. The finding of labor abuse poses a major problem for foreign companies that depend on these minerals in advanced technology and clean energy. It remains to be seen how many of these companies will be willing to seek alternative sources of the minerals on finding that forced labor gave them access to the minerals. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
When I'm feeling a little bit low, I listen to my radio. 90.7 on the FM dial. It's always sure to make me smile. KBOO. Boo! This is Michelle Shock saying howdy.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to Cable News In Depth. Through the bankruptcy sale of 23andMe, the pharmaceutical giant Regeneron is gaining access to one of the largest consumer genetic databases, the DNA information of over 15 million users. J.B. Branch is the big tech accountability advocate for Congress Watch at Public Citizen. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with him about 23andMe and what its data will mean for Regeneron and for the public.
First of all, what's 23andMe for our listeners who might not know that? And, yeah, and why are they selling to Regeneron?
Right. So 23andMe, it really started off as sort of that Ancestry.com flavor of consumer products. It was starting off as a way for people to connect to other relatives that they might have had out there. It was also being able to tell you a bit more about your genetic history. If you had, you know, a predisposition to diabetes, for example, or high cholesterol, or if cancer might run in your family. And so in order for them to do that, you had to provide them with a sample of your DNA, which was often done by folks sitting into a tube, and then their lab folks did what they needed to provide you the information you needed. 23andMe came upon some hard times. Their sales started dropping. They even had a data breach not too long ago where Chinese and Ashkenazi Jews folks were being targeted, you know, with racist vocabulary and actions. To make a very long story short, they actually filed for Chapter 11. And in that process, they started selling their assets. The most valuable thing that they had was that collection of DNA. And so they were able to sell that collection of DNA to Regeneron for over $250 million.
So what's going to happen now? What's Regeneron going to do with that? And how significant is it that they have access to that data?
Right. Well, Regeneron is a pharmaceutical company. They actually have their own DNA labs where they can run some DNA. And our thought process is that Regeneron is likely going to use 23andMe's user DNA database to provide either directly connected or targeted pharmaceuticals. They might be able to use the DNA to create new vaccines, new medications that could also be targeted to consumers as well. The big value to Regeneron in purchasing this DNA database from 23andMe is the profitability of it. They can create new products, they can target consumers, and again, they might even be able to make some new drugs or vaccines based off of the DNA that is stored in that database.
So they would argue, this is a great thing. We could really help people with this new data, right?
Yeah. So Regeneron is going to argue that they're going to keep your data safe, that this is going to be a win-win for everyone because they'll be able to cure so many diseases and things like that. They've even put out a statement saying that they will protect the consumer data. But what we find time and time again is that these databases end up being hacked, which obviously is a huge concern that already happened to 23andMe. And the other thing too, you know, there wasn't a renewed consent for the 23andMe consumers, right? For the users. So they had previously entered into a contractual agreement with 23andMe. They didn't anticipate that years down the road, 23andMe might file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And they didn't anticipate a giant pharmaceutical company purchasing that information. It gives consumers a gross and icky feeling to think that the most intimate part of who you are, the essence of who you are, your DNA, might be commodified, purchased by a pharmaceutical company, and they might use a portion of that to profit off of you without you receiving any form of compensation.
So are there laws on the books that will protect people's personal information? Or maybe there are, but they're not enough?
Right. So that's the big gap that we need filled, and it's going to require federal legislation. It requires Congress to step up. You know, I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of HIPAA, which is patient privacy, but that's primarily with your doctors and health insurance companies, third parties, how they can use that. But HIPAA was written in the 1990s. And so HIPAA wasn't designed for a world in which there's artificial intelligence, for a world in which people are giving their DNA directly to for-profit companies. That just didn't exist in the 90s. And so a lot of what HIPAA protects wouldn't actually protect this type of situation. And so that's why we need Congress to step up and pass comprehensive data privacy laws. And I would specifically say a law that provides users a right to be deleted. so that if you have your data wandering out there somewhere with a company that you've formally either entered into an agreement with or were a user for, and now you no longer want to, you should be able to have that deleted automatically. And you should be able to reach out to that company and say, hey, look, I don't want you to have my data anymore. Please delete it.
Is this one of those, yet another one of those situations where the technology has moved too fast for the legislators and they just have to catch up?
In some respects, I mean, definitely that's the case with AI now coming into play, where there's all this DNA data that could be out there that could be sort of used alongside AI. But I would argue this has been a problem a long time coming. 23andMe isn't new. It's been around for quite some time. Ancestry.com has a similar sort of like DNA program. They've been around for a very long time. So it's more of congressional inaction as opposed to the technology being too quick.
And what about Regeneron's competitors? Are they pissed off, or do they feel that this purchase is unfair and should be stopped, or should have been stopped?
We certainly don't see anyone advocating for the consumer side, aside from ourselves. I mean, you know, there's a lot of concern amongst the consumer privacy community. But from a corporate standpoint, you know, there aren't many big tech companies speaking out against this. And I think part of the reason why is because the healthcare market is huge. And all of that data is just so valuable. And so, you know, if you're an AI company, if you can get your hands on some DNA from a company that's going under, you might be able to, you know, take that data, incorporate it with your AI, and maybe come up with some new cures, maybe, you know, provide some new products. And that's the concern. It's a real slippery slope. I mean, once you start selling this data from one company to another, who's to say when Regeneron, if they were to file for bankruptcy, someone else purchases it, like, what are they going to do with that data, right? So you don't want this stuff trading hands time and time again.
Are there better controls on this type of situation in other countries?
Yeah. So in the European Union, I mean, they have a right to delete. And again, you know, that's any information online that's incorrect about you, you can have it corrected pretty quickly in the European Union. That includes when you have buyer's remorse and you decide, hey, you know, on second thought, I actually don't want this company to have my data. Please delete it. The EU is often considered to be, in terms of user privacy, one of the leading nations or countries when it comes to this.
How much influence does Public Citizen and other consumer-oriented groups have in Congress on this kind of issue?
Yeah, I mean, Public Citizen, we've been around for quite some time. We're a leading consumer rights organization. I think right now, this type of data privacy, it's not a, what I say is it's not a dinner table conversation, right? This isn't hitting your wallet. This isn't hitting the groceries, and it doesn't impact your ability to, you know, keep the lights on in your home. Those are the primary worries that people are having in this current economic environment. But what I will say is that, you know, data privacy impacts all of us. And this is a particular instance with this DNA. You know, DNA is, it's community oriented. If I provide my DNA, 23andMe is able to capture information about siblings, about relatives through your family tree and through your genome. That's how they're, you know, if you hear about these unsolved murder mysteries and they're able to, you know, crack open a case that's been silent for 40, 50 years, they're able to do that using DNA from distant relatives who submitted samples years ago who had nothing to do with the crime. So it's 15 million people who are implicated here, but it's 15 million people's family trees. So it's not just the person who submitted it, but it's likely a whole chunk of people within their family tree. That's why, you know, everyone should be concerned about this.
And anything else you want to add to what you've said?
For individuals who might have submitted their DNA to 23andMe, there was an opportunity to go to the 23andMe website and have your data deleted. When a lot of people rushed to the website, it actually crashed. And so some folks weren't able to have their data deleted. I would encourage folks to go back and try to have their data deleted. And if you find that you can't do it, I'd encourage you to reach out to state representatives, to reach out to congressional representatives and senators, because, you know, this issue is flying under the radar, and it's incredibly important. I mean, we don't want to be living in a world in which the most intimate aspects of ourselves, our DNA, our cells, are being sold around and profited on.
Yeah, you do hear people say that privacy is dead, you know, and there's nothing we can do about it. But you're saying, no, that's not true.
No, we can't give up that way.
That's J.B. Branch of Public Citizen speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You're listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Camp KBOO is in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through June 29th. All you have to do is check out kboo.fm